Welcome to the Ultimate Soulmate Summit, brought to you by The Soulmate Secret and the Calling in the One online course with your hosts, Arielle Ford and Claire Zammit. Today's Soulmate Seminar is with Lori Gottlieb on the topic, Your Soulmate May Not Be Your Type, Understanding the Difference Between Compromise and Settling and Why This Is Critical to Finding Lasting Love. Lori Gottlieb is the New York Times best-selling author of Marry Him, The Case for Settling for Mr. Good Enough. She has written for the New York Times, The Atlantic, Elle, Glamour, Self, Time and People. She has discussed modern relationships on The Today Show, CNN, Good Morning America, The Early Show, CNBC, Dr. Phil, NPR, and Oprah Radio.
Welcome, Lori, to the Ultimate Soulmate Summit.
Well, thank you. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
So are we. We've been talking about it all day.
So it was quite a controversial book when it first came out, Marry Him, The Case for Settling for Mr. Good Enough. I believe the paperback has just been released.
Mm-hmm.
Well, wonder if you can start maybe sharing your story and how you came to write the book.
It actually originated because I was one of these people who, like many of my friends, you know, was kind of had a very specific idea of the kind of guy that I thought I would end up with. And I would date men who seemed like that kind of guy, and I was always kind of in these relationships, but they never worked out in the end. I mean, you know, we would date for a couple of years or, you know, 2-3 years, and then we would realize we weren't that compatible when it came to kind of, you know, the long term for, you know, what we wanted in life and if we were going to get married. And so something wasn't working. It was like something was wrong with the type that I had and I couldn't figure it out. And so I actually ended up, you know, then I was kind of in my late 30s and I decided I really wanted a child. So I had a baby on my own. And I started to hang out with married people a lot because once you have a baby, believe me, your single friends do not want to hang out with you all that much. So I started hanging out with married people, and they'd say things about their husbands like, you know, oh, I'm so in love with my husband. Do you know that he fed the baby in the middle of the night? Or, you know, like these things that are really not that glamorous, but that when you are married, you know, they're really meaningful. And they were sharing this kind of, you know, adventure together. And this is not the kind of thing that the media talks about when we, you know, talk about love or when we envision love. And it wasn't anything that I think even women talk about. They grow up thinking, you know, I'm not going to compromise in any way. I want my Prince Charming. And a lot of the people that my friends were married to were probably not the definition of Prince Charming that, you know, the media might have or that many of us might have if you, like, put these men in a dating lineup. But my friends were totally in love with them. They were head over heels in love with their husbands. Not that everything was perfect, but that's love. And I started to reevaluate and think, wait a minute, maybe we're looking for the wrong things when we're dating if what we're looking for is that long-term lasting love as opposed to the high of the initial romance. So that was how I came to kind of explore the topic, you know, from the very beginning. That was sort of the seed of the idea of looking at, you know, looking at the topic that I wanted to look at.
And what was the hardest thing for you to overcome in changing your perspective on your type?
Well, you know, what I did in Marry Him was I'm a journalist, and I went out to try to find some answers. So in terms of changing my perspective, I was kind of like a dating guinea pig. I would go out, and I talked to neurobiologists about chemistry and what that really is. I talked to behavioral economists about how we make choices. And how it's so confusing, especially with things like online dating. I talked to sociologists about how the culture influences the way we look at love. I talked to historians about love over time. I talked to, you know, our mothers. I talked to clergy. I talked to so many different people. And I talked to marital researchers about, you know, what are the qualities that make for these happy long-term marriages. And I would interview them, and I would get the information. And a lot of it was really surprising to me. And I would try it out in the real world. And so I think what really changed my perspective was actually trying out what they said in the real world and realizing that it was working so much better than what I had been doing in the past.
And I know you worked with Evan Mark Katz, who's
mm-hmm.
a dating coach for you. What was that like?
It was so interesting. You know, I was one of these people who thought a dating coach, why would anybody need a dating coach? Well, people need dating coaches because people are doing it wrong. And I think they need that outside perspective. Because I think that we're unrealistic not only in terms of what we're looking for, but in terms of, you know, what we think we offer. And that's not to say that we aren't, you know, great catches. I think a lot of us, you know, probably have a lot to offer, but we forget that just as we're going to have to put up with somebody else's less than ideal qualities, somebody has to put up with ours. So I remember when I was working with Evan, you know, at one point he said to me, you know, you are forgetting that, you know, he says, instead of making this list of all the things you're looking for in a guy, I want you to make a list of everything that a guy would have to put up with to spend his life with you. And at first I wrote down, you know, a couple of things. And he said, that's it? That's it? I had like three or four things on the list. And I said, what? You know what? And he said, I want you to make a list as long as the list of things that you're looking for in a guy. So, you know, I think what happened was I realized that the things that I thought were kind of cute and quirky and endearing about me are actually really annoying. And I think that a lot of us think, you know, like, oh, you know, this thing that I have about neatness, well, that's actually really annoying and I'm very rigid and hard to live with. It's not like this cute thing like Holly Hunter, you know? And so it really opened my eyes to, you know what, some guy is going to put up with all of this. But in the research that I did in Marry Him, I realized that the statistics show when men and women take surveys, men are so much more forgiving, and we think of men so differently in our culture. We think, oh, well, they're so picky, and, you know, they have to have someone who looks exactly like this and acts exactly like this. Men are actually much more able to compromise, and they're much more realistic about, you know, this is the woman that I'm in love with, and this woman has these qualities that may not be ideal, but, you know, overall, that's okay because I'm in love with her. And it doesn't mean that he loves those qualities. They are annoying, but he's perfectly willing to put up with them because, you know, they realize that we're just human beings and human beings are flawed. Women have very low tolerance for the flaws that they find in men. And in fact, they'll come home from a date or they'll be in a relationship and they'll complain about their boyfriend to their friends. And their friends will say, like, oh my God, he didn't call at this time. Dump him. Forget it. Go find somebody else. Even though maybe he's like a doctor and he was on call and he couldn't call at that time. But we hold men to such rigid standards that, you know, it's almost like we're impossible to please.
Mm. Oh, I'm sure no one can relate to that.
So what were your own transformations that you went through in the process and what happened as a result?
Well,
what did you start to see, and then how did you actually meet your soulmate?
Well, the thing is that I think that one thing I learned was that the definition of insanity is, you know, doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. And I kept doing the same thing over and over. I kept changing kind of intellectually. I could see what all of the scientists and researchers were saying in the book, and, you know, they had like all this amazing information that it's not what we think about normally. So I really had to kind of change my whole perspective on what it meant to find a partner. And I think a lot of us would say, and I would have said before Marry Him, I would have said, you know, I'm realistic. I don't have these, you know, crazy standards. But then when you're out in the dating world and you really talk to women and you really kind of drill down to how they're dating and what they're doing, they do have these impossible standards. A lot of them do, even though they don't really think that they do. And I was guilty of that as well. And so I think part of it was kind of making the same mistakes over and over and over, and then realizing that, you know, too many times seeing the lost opportunities, seeing the men that I was kind of nixing for ridiculous reasons, and realizing then, like, you know, that this was not going to help me find the person that I wanted to be with. And so I really had to change that. And, you know, it was a combination of doing all of the research, talking to all of these experts, interviewing, you know, hundreds of men and women and seeing them, you know, what made them happy, what mistakes they made. And then, you know, working with a matchmaker, working with a dating coach, I was really, you know, I was living my research. And it was really eye-opening.
So how important was it for you to become more open-minded and flexible?
Well, you know, it's very important, but I think that people often hear those words, open-minded and flexible, and they think that that means settling. And it doesn't mean settling at all. It really means, you know, I think that a lot of women are really picky about things that don't matter. Like, they'll be on a date with somebody and they'll say, oh, you know, we were having a really good time and then he did this Austin Powers impression and it just turned me off, so I don't want to go out with him again. And, you know, like, that really doesn't matter unless he does Austin Powers impressions all the time. But if he just did it that once and he was nervous and he was trying to impress you, you know, I think women just discard so easily. And I think that, on the other hand, they're not picky enough about things that do matter. Like, one guy in the book had said to me, you know, I really wanted to go out with this woman in grad school, but she wouldn't go out with me because she didn't think I was literary enough, even though he was, you know, he was very literary, but she didn't give him a chance to discover that about him. But instead, she was dating someone from her creative writing program, and he wouldn't call when he said he would. He was unreliable. And she said, you know, she's madly in love with this guy, and he makes her miserable. And she eventually did break up with that guy. But, you know, it's like she wasn't picky enough about what mattered, which was, you know, being there for the other person, being reliable. That's hugely important. And so, you know, I think it, when we talk about compromising and being flexible, we have to remember it doesn't mean that you're lowering your standards. It means that you're having standards that are healthy. And there's a big difference between lowering your standards and having healthy standards.
So what are the kinds of things that it's important not to compromise on? Character, values, what do you see about that?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, of course nobody should compromise on those things. You know, one of the people that I interviewed for the book said the most underrated qualities that women just completely seem to forget to look for, that they just assume are there, but often they're not, are kindness and generosity.
Mm.
And, you know, they're so wrapped up in, like, you know, how quickly their heart beats when they, you know, the guy walks into the room for the first time. And they're really wrapped up in kind of that initial chemistry rush that they often are overlooking qualities like kindness and generosity of spirit. And I think also something that they forget too is life goals and compatibility. Do they want the same things in life? You can have a great time with a guy and he can be kind and generous, but maybe he wants a completely different lifestyle than you do. So is there a way that you guys can compromise, or are you just completely incompatible? You know, there are certain things, like maybe one of you wants kids and one of you doesn't want kids. You can't have half a kid. How do you compromise on that one? You know, maybe one of you wants to, like, travel a lot and that's your lifestyle, and the other one of you really wants kind of more of a stable home base. You know, you really have to think about what kind of life you want. Sometimes there are issues over, you know, money issues. Like, you know, somebody says, well, it's okay if we're kind of, you know, freelance and we kind of live paycheck to paycheck, and the other person may feel really anxious in that kind of situation. So it's things like that that, you know, people are scared to talk about because they sound so unromantic, but you have to be compatible on the day-to-day of life, like how you want to run your lives day-to-day. And when you're in that same house, you know, are you guys compatible? For example, and I don't want to give away the end of the book, but, you know, the guy who's my boyfriend is somebody that I wasn't even going to email on Match.com because even though he had an interesting profile, I made these assumptions about him. Like, first of all, he was shorter than I would ever date in the past. And I should mention that I'm maybe 5'2 on a good day. I mean, like, maybe with heels. I'm like 5'2 with 1-inch heels, I guess. You know, I mean, I'm not a tall person, so it's very funny that I had these sort of standards about height. And I just said, you know, I'm not going to be attracted to somebody who's that short. And he was kind of, you know, losing his hair, and I said, no, I have to have hair. And but he was cute, but he was just, you know, on the shorter side and losing his hair. And he listed his job, like, it's an occupation, and he said real estate. And I said, oh my God, like, I'm a creative person. I can't be with someone in real estate. That's boring. What does he do? He just, like, goes to open houses. That's so boring. We would have nothing to talk about. And yet he had a really interesting profile. So because I was changing the way I was doing things, I actually ended up emailing him And, you know, all of the assumptions I made were totally wrong. When I saw him, I actually thought he was really cute. So this whole idea that, like, I couldn't be attracted to a guy who was, you know, under my height requirement was ridiculous. And this whole thing about the real estate, he actually was way more creative than I am. He had gone to, you know, architecture school and would, like, design and renovate buildings and then sell them. And it was actually an incredibly creative profession that he was in. So I think that I really changed, and that, you know, if someone said, like, I want to set you up on a date with this guy, I just would have ruled him out and said, no, you know, set me up with, like, the cool writer. And that was sort of my type, you know, the cool creative guy, the cool intellectual guy.
Like, and, like the guy on Californication?
Oh, I haven't seen the show.
Oh, you haven't?
No.
Oh, he's the too cool for school writer type. Yeah. And he's very hot, but very dysfunctional.
Right. Well, that's the thing. And so I would end up with people who, you know, I wouldn't say that they were dysfunctional. I would say that we just weren't compatible. Like one guy who was this cool writer guy that I was dating, who's a wonderful guy, and we're still friends to this day. But he was so incredibly quirky in terms of his lifestyle. You know, I wanted a more kind of conventional life, and he lives this really quirky, unusual, artsy life, and he didn't want the same things that I wanted, and I didn't want the same things he wanted, and so we had to break up. And, you know, had we kind of looked at that early on, we wouldn't have stayed together for the couple of years that we did. We wouldn't have wasted that time. And so I think people really do need to look at those things. You know, are you compatible in these ways?
So let's talk about the list. What stays on, what goes off?
Well, I got rid of my list entirely because I think, you know, I start the book with this list. A friend said to me, you know, make a list of all the things you're looking for because you are so picky. And this is a married friend. And she said, you are so picky. And I really never thought of myself as picky. I really thought, you know, I just know what I'm attracted to, and so why waste my time with people that I'm not going to be interested in? But I didn't think I was unusually picky at all, and, you know, I always kind of had boyfriends, and what I didn't realize was they were all the same type, even though they kind of looked different on the surface. They were all sort of this genre of guy that I would always date, and a lot of women do that. They don't realize that they're kind of dating the same kind of guy over and over and over, and it's not working. So she told me, you know, yeah, you do have all this big list and everything. And I said, I don't. I just always kind of like fall in love. And she said, write down what you're looking for. And it took me, and this is kind of embarrassing, but it took me maybe like 3 minutes to write down, I think, 65 things that would be like my ideal qualities in a guy. And that really was eye-opening because, you know, I didn't think that I was carrying around that list in my head, but obviously that was in the back of my head when I would meet someone. I kind of would probably go through this mental checklist of, you know, is he that kind of guy? And it's very limiting. And what I really had to do when I was dating, and what, you know, a lot of women, you know, it's not just my story, it's the story of many women. What a lot of women in the book ended up doing was they had to kind of get rid of that mental checklist that they were carrying around so that they could meet the guy who they would actually fall in love with.
Hmm. I know that you did a lot of research on the book. Did you come up with anything that explains the difference between attraction and dysfunctional patterns?
Yes, actually I did. I talked to a lot of psychologists for the book. And what they were saying was that a lot of times what we think of as that, you know, chemistry and the butterflies and the sparks when you first meet someone is this sort of unconscious pull that you have toward, you know, there's sort of healthy chemistry and unhealthy chemistry. And part of it is, you know, your healthy chemistry, what you're just sort of attracted to. But sometimes you feel those sparks and butterflies because there's something familiar about the person. And maybe it's something familiar that's not so great. Like, you know, let's say that your father was, you know, not very available because he was always working. And then you end up, you know, with like a similar kind of guy, but he's very attractive because he's kind of the alpha guy and he's very successful and charismatic. And you don't realize that it's sort of like the same dynamic that was there with your father. And then you get really angry because your boyfriend is never available. Well, hello, all those sparks and everything that you felt in the beginning, part of that might have been because you were drawn to the familiar. You were drawn to that kind of guy. And so there's a lot about in the book about, you know, the sort of unhealthy ways that we're drawn to people, and we think that that's our type, and we think that that's chemistry, but that's not actually chemistry. That's actually unresolved childhood conflict that you need to work out in order to make healthier choices.
How important is it to have chemistry with the person that you get together with?
It's extremely important. I don't think that anybody should be with somebody if they don't have chemistry. The question is, you know, how do you define chemistry? Somebody in the book said, you know, a lot, I think it was Evan actually, said that a lot of people, they think that they need, you know, they end up with sort of like a chemistry of a 10 or a 9 and a compatibility of a 4. But they think that they're much more compatible than they are. You know, we both love sushi and rollerblading and hiking and the same books and the same movies. But that's not really compatibility. They're just sort of blinded by the chemistry and they have fun together, but they're really kind of incompatible. And he was saying, you know, you shouldn't look for like a chemistry of a 9 and a compatibility of a 4. What you really need is kind of like a chemistry and a compatibility of a 7, where they're both kind of like, you know, there's a healthy amount of both and nothing's going to be perfect. You're not going to have like a 10 on the chemistry. You're not going to have a 10 on the compatibility. But, you know, a 7 should be pretty good. And I think people kind of expect the 10, and if it's not there, they move on. And research shows, interestingly enough, that the 10 does not actually make people happy. You end up with the 10, and instead of being happy with that, over time, you kind of adapt. It's kind of like if you walk into an air-conditioned room, and at first you think, this is fabulous, this is great, it feels so nice in here, and then like an hour in, you forget that the air conditioning is even there and it's not so great anymore. Well, you get used to your spouse or your boyfriend, and so like he might be a 10 in the beginning, but like over the years, he's going to be more like an 8, you know, in terms of the chemistry, because you're so used to him, it's not going to be as hot as it was in the beginning. So I think that people just end up kind of disappointed, you know. So what Evan was saying was, if you, you know, have like a good amount of chemistry and a good amount of compatibility, that's a much healthier choice than kind of reaching for this, it has to be perfect, because it's not going to stay perfect.
Makes sense. So many women think that they're going to know when they meet a man in the very first 30 seconds that, you know, this is their type or this is the one. What did you learn about that?
Yeah, I talked to this researcher who actually studied people over time from like the moment they met to, you know, what happened. I think it was 10 or 20 years. I'd have to look in Merriam to see. And what she found was that so at the time when they first met, she had them tell like their story of like, you know, what was it like when you first met, when you first saw each other, that first moment, tell me about your first date, tell me what, you know, and she'd do this in real time, not like people's recollections of it, but she'd do it in real time. So she had all this data and, you know, and then a year later she'd interview them about, you know, how they were doing in their relationships, if they got married, you know, how did they do in their marriages. And she would talk to them every, you know, year or whatever, 5 years or whatever it was. And then what she would do is she would ask them again about when they first met. And if they were happy in their marriages, they would like embellish that first date story, not on purpose, but it was just like, it was sort of like it had evolved into something else. Like we knew right away and it was love at first sight. And, you know, they tell that story. But in reality, when they had told her the story, when it actually happened, they were like, yeah, you know, I wasn't so sure. Yeah, I had a pretty good time, but yeah, I wasn't really sure. But I went on a second date because my mom said I should, you know, or, you know, like these kinds of stories. And so they really had a different experience than they were telling years later. But if they were unhappy in their marriages, they actually told a more negative story than it actually happened. Like, I wasn't really that attracted to him the first time I met him, when in reality they had told her, yeah, I was pretty attracted to him. And so when I think single people hear these stories from married people, they have to remember that married people are not telling the accurate version of what really happened the first time they met. They're telling the version that is sort of told through this lens of what their relationship is like now. So a lot of single people, myself included, would hear these stories a lot about like, oh, I just knew when I met him, I was so excited, we had the best first date. But in reality, it might not have been like that, because people are always kind of changing their stories. But I thought, well, if all these happily married people had these amazing first dates, then it must be that if I don't have that immediate feeling on this date, then that's not the guy for me. And it was a really bad way of going about dating.
How long should you date a man before you kind of, you know, decide to pass if you're not quite sure?
Yeah, I don't think that there's any set time period. I think it's more about being open-minded in the beginning. So, you know, I mean, if you go on a first date with someone and there's really nothing there, then I wouldn't tell people, well, then go on a second date, because why? But I think if you had like a pretty good time, and I don't mean like there were sparks or anything, just like, you know, the person you thought was like reasonably attractive, he might not be your ideal type, but you know, he's a reasonably attractive person, and you had a good enough time, then I would say go on a second date. Because often on first dates, and I interviewed so many men for Marry Him also, and men would say that when they were on a first date, they felt like they were sitting across from an Olympic judge, you know, holding up those placards with the numbers on it. And they would, instead of getting points for everything they were doing right, like, you know, like, oh, he was so polite, and oh, he's really funny, and, you know, just like the nice things that he's doing at dinner, that women would be like these Olympic judges who would deduct points for any little error that they committed. Like, you know, oh my God, he did you see the way he laughed? Take off, you know, 2 points. Or he's in therapy, really? Take off another point. Did you hear what he said about his last girlfriend? You know, whatever it was. And they'll just deduct it. And by the end of the evening, one guy said, like, I'm really an 8, but at the end of the evening, I could be a 2, because like I've gotten so many points deducted for things that I don't even know that I'm doing, only because I'm nervous and I like the girl and I'm trying to impress her. And maybe on the second date, he would be a little bit more normal, or he wouldn't be as nervous or awkward, and she would actually enjoy him and be less judgmental and critical, because he's actually more relaxed. Because now that he has the second date, he's more relaxed, and he says, oh, okay, she's going on a second date with me, so I feel a little bit more comfortable, and, you know, both people can relax a little more on that second date.
Yeah, I know. I always felt really awkward on a first date, so I can sort of relate to that. It's like, oh, nerve-wracking. I've read somewhere where you talk about a reverse power curve in dating. Can you tell us what that is and how to make it work in our favor?
I wish I could make it work in our favor. You know, this is just this phenomenon that I think a lot of women feel is somehow an idea that I made up, which it's not. It's actually something that, you know, one of the people that I interviewed for the book was explaining to me, and actually several people then reiterated it in different ways. But it all came down to the same thing, which is that a lot of women don't like the idea that we become it's harder to find a mate as we get older. They don't like that idea at all, because it makes us feel sort of like powerless or helpless, and, you know, because we can't help it that we're getting older. But basically what women do is they sabotage themselves, because they don't want to take that into account. So what they do is, like, when you're about 27, you're kind of at the top of the dating totem pole. You can date older, you can date younger, you know, you're kind of like in this really good place. And so those women are turning down men left and right because, and I don't mean that, like, by the way, that every woman has like all these guys and all these suitors or anything like that, but I do mean that I think women at that age have an idea that the dating world is always going to be like it is when you're 27. That they think, well, I know it gets harder, people say that, but when I'm 37 and when I'm 47, you know, I'm still going to be cute and young at heart and interesting, and someone's going to figure, you know, see how special I am, and they're going to love me for who I am, and they won't care how old I am. Well, it doesn't quite work that way. And so, you know, a lot of women, when they're in their late 20s and they have more opportunity, they are kind of, you know, they'll be dating an 8, let's say, you know, just to kind of shorthand it. They'll be dating an 8, and but they like kind of are not sure. They're not really sure. They're kind of holding out for the 10. So they like break up with the 8 to hold out for the 10. And then it's like 10 years later, and now they have, you know, they broke up with the 8 to hold out for the 10, and now they're like almost 40, and they can only get a 5. I mean, that's settling. You don't want the 5. You want the 8, which is not settling. The 8 is a catch. But they don't realize that when they're like in their late 20s, because they have these like Prince Charming fantasies. And so what they do is they kind of hurt themselves by not paying attention to the men who are interested in them and who they're interested in when they're younger, because they're kind of looking over their shoulder for something better.
So, Laurie, we have this expectation that to be happy, we need a mate who is our best friend, our lover, our therapist, our spiritual partner, our tennis partner, in some cases our business partner, is our hiking partner. Now, is it realistic or even necessary to have a mate that fits, you know, fulfills every single one of our needs to be happy?
Right. It's not. And that's what I think a lot of the researchers were talking about, that, you know, when you look, and not just the researchers, but I actually interviewed a lot of, you know, really happily married couples. And, you know, a lot of them would say, my husband wasn't the kind of guy that I expected to marry. And I'm so glad that I married him. You know, even though I thought I would need to have someone who, you know, shared this interest of mine, or, you know, did this, or, you know, whatever it is, they had these ideas. One person can't fulfill all those things in you. And we have this kind of fantasy, this very romantic fantasy that, you know, he's going to be your best friend. And in reality, the women, you know, when you actually ask married women, they'll say, like, yeah, my husband's my best friend, but it's different from, like, my girlfriend best friend, because he doesn't want to talk necessarily about some of the topics that I'm interested in. You know, he just doesn't have the passion for them, so I talk to my girlfriends about those things. And guys would say, you know, your spouse doesn't need to be one-stop shopping, is how one guy put it. You know, he said, like, I have my work friends, I have my, you know, my brother, I have my, you know, these people and those people. I have, like, different groups of people who satisfy different things, and I have my wife who satisfies these other things. And, you know, yes, they feel like they're very close and connected, and there's a lot of passion and all of that. But, you know, are they best friends in the sense of, like, they share every interest, they, you know, they always get each other, they have that, like, telepathic finishing each other's sentences thing? No, not all the time. And that doesn't have to be that way. In fact, most of the time it's not, and that's normal.
So one of the questions I had for you is, what are the most common mistakes you see women making when they're dating?
Well, I mean, you know, some of the things we've talked about, I think that women make assumptions very quickly, and they start telling, you know, themselves kind of an entire life story about a guy before they've even met him. So you'll see a guy online, for example, and kind of like what I did, you know, I sort of told the story to myself, oh, he must be boring, he's in real estate. Or they'll see a guy who writes something in his profile, and they just make these assumptions that, like, he's this kind of guy and he's like that, or he's a commitment phobe, or, you know, whatever it is. And they haven't even, you know, exchanged an email with him or been on the phone with him or met him, and they've already kind of, like, ruled him out to move on. And I think part of the problem is that, you know, particularly with online dating, but it happens out in the world too, is that we have this, you know, especially with, like, Facebook and just the speed at which our culture moves nowadays, we always think that, like, there's always going to be another opportunity. So, and that we don't want to kind of take time to get to know somebody because, you know, if it's not there, we feel like then something's wrong if it's not there in the beginning. So even on Match.com, for example, like, you'll email a guy, and then immediately what pops up on your screen is, and here are five more people just like guy XYZ that you just emailed. You might want to take a look at them. Now, that happens on, like, BananaRepublic.com, where, like, I order a blouse, and they're like, and here are five more items you might like, you know. And so it makes it sort of like a shopping experience, which is not how people fall in love with, you know, with this kind of consumerist mentality. And so, like, what happens is you email the guy, and then you've got five other guys who, like, look kind of interesting. Maybe one or two of those five look interesting, and you'll email them too. And now you're corresponding with all these different guys, and it's really hard to get to know somebody when you're multitasking in that way. And you know, this idea of kind of, like, shopping around is really making it hard for a lot of people to find a connection. And the other part of it is that as somebody said in Merriam, you know, when you're shopping, the clothes don't point out the shopper's own flaws. You know, you're kind of like, you can pick whatever you want. You walk into the store, you say, I want this, and, you know, you can get that. But when you're kind of looking around for somebody to spend your life with, you know, and you have all these, like, things on your checklist, you're forgetting that, you know, he has things on his checklist too, and you know, he may not, you know, the guy that you pick out may not pick you out. So you can't just treat this like a shopping experience. It's more about, like, a mutual connection, and people lose sight of that nowadays. So I would say that's one of our greatest mistakes.
Did you discover, after you learned all of this, that there was somebody from your past that you totally, you know, glossed over that, you know, could you go back and change things? You would have really given them a shot.
Yes. You know, I wrote this chapter called The Men Who Got Away. And what I did was I actually went back, and this is sort of a mortifying thing to do, so I did it for people so they don't have to do it themselves and humiliate themselves. But I went back, and I looked at a couple of people who I, you know, now think, what was I thinking? Why did I rule them out? These weren't people that I actually dated. I think all the people, you know, I would only get into a relationship with people if they kind of met my mental checklist. Which I didn't even know that I had. It was completely unconscious. But you know, there were people that I ruled out for other reasons that you know, I went back and I kind of interviewed and did some research. And I thought, you know, like, who knows what would have happened? You know, you have no idea. But I felt like I wouldn't even give them a chance. And that was the scary part, that these were guys who were interested in me that I didn't give a chance to because I had some preconceived idea about why they should just be a guy friend and why they wouldn't be a good match for me. And then I also, in that chapter, to take the other side of this, there was a guy that I thought was my perfect ideal guy. And I actually contacted him and got to know him a little bit and realized that, oh my God, he was so toxic. And like, you know, so, you know, in terms of like, he didn't want, I don't mean like a toxic person. He wasn't a mean person at all, but he was somebody who was like incredibly, you know, not the kind of guy who wanted anything like the kind of life that I wanted. He was as kind of critical and picky about what he wanted as, you know, I had been. And he was what one of the people that I interviewed for the book was Barry Schwartz, who wrote The Paradox of Choice. And he calls those people maximizers. They're people who like have to have everything. They're, you know, they're always like looking for the best everything, whether like shopping for a car, or shopping for an iPod, or, you know, shopping for a sweater, or looking for a mate. And he was a maximizer, and it's really hard for two maximizers to be together. And so a lot of times what happens is like maximizers are dating maximizers, and you know, and they both find the other one flawed, and it never works out. So I went back and looked at those three men. I looked at like two who I had kind of let go and one who I, you know, thought was my fantasy, and it turned out would not have been my fantasy. And it was very eye-opening.
Are you still with the real estate guy now?
No. He moved away early on. So I don't want to give away sort of the whole ending of the book, but yeah, I don't want to give it away.
Oh, okay.
The whole story is in the book.
You know, and I read the book, but my memory is so bad, I forgot. That's really funny.
So with all that you've learned and all that you've been through, what advice would you give our listeners on the journey to finding true love and fulfillment?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that I wasn't trying to write an advice book. What I was trying to do was to put all of the information out there. It's the kind of book that, you know, I never had 10, 15 years ago when I really could have used it. I mean, I think that to have all of this in one place is really important, because I don't think people talk about love in the way that, you know, the people that I talk to in the book do. And it was, you know, I never really had that information. It's not the way that people talk about dating nowadays. And I think, like, you know, while I certainly don't want to go back to, you know, my mother's generation or the generation before, I think there was one benefit of that, which was you had sort of community wisdom. You would have a lot of, like, close-knit communities where people were kind of in the same place where they grew up, and people knew them, and they would set you up with other people that they knew, and they could kind of talk some sense into you sometimes if you were being a little bit irrational, and they would tell you what was important in marriage, and they would talk about marriage more. People don't really talk about that. As I said, it wasn't until I had a kid that I really started hanging out with married people a lot, and I was really hearing the kind of nitty-gritty of their marriages in a way that they don't really share with single people. So, you know, I really tried to put that information in one place and not write an advice book, but let people see what happened with me and see what happened with the other men and women in the book, and let them kind of draw their own conclusions about what kinds of changes they might want to make in their own dating lives, you know, what kind of shifts they might want to make. And it's not like, you know, it's not like step one, step two, step three. It's more about, you know, what resonates with you when you read this, and what do you think you, how do you see yourself in this, and what might you want to change?
What did you discover about the couples who had the most fulfilling and happy marriages in terms of the different qualities that each of the partners cultivated?
I think that they had the qualities that were so important in marriage, which are, you know, flexibility, compromise. A lot of women have certain expectations about what marriage is going to be like. And, you know, maybe part of that is, you know, when we watch romantic comedies at the end, they sort of, you know, they get married and then we never see what happens in the marriage. Because marriage is actually kind of boring and in a good way. Like, it's nice, it's stable. You know, you have companionship, you have sex, you have all these great things, but it doesn't look like kind of the drama of what these romantic comedies are about. And that's a good thing, because you don't want to be in this drama-filled marriage. And so I think that a lot of people, like, have no idea what marriage is about. And I think that's a huge problem. So they don't realize that, you know, marriage is not about, as you said earlier, that the guy is going to kind of entertain you constantly and always be in a good mood and, you know, always do the thing that you want, like picking up toilet paper on the way home from work, or, you know, like that kind of thing. That people need forgiveness. They need flexibility. They need to realize that it's not his job to be your prince, you know, Prince Charming, in terms of like the sense of entitlement and kind of, you know, why didn't you bring me this, or why didn't you do this, and kind of that kind of nagging. It's really a team. And I think I said at one point in the book, and I think some people find this notion, if you're not married, find it kind of unromantic, but married people find it very romantic, which, you know, I said that marriage is kind of like kind of a business, you know. It's kind of like a nonprofit business where you guys are a team and you're kind of running this household together. And there's something very romantic about the minutia of that, the day-to-day of that, that doesn't look anything like romance in, you know, our sort of conventional idea of it. So I think that the people who had the qualities for the day-to-day life of marriage were the people who succeeded.
So what are you looking for now in terms of dating or relationship?
I think it's you know, the things that I talk about in the book. I mean, I think it's about finding somebody that you really enjoy being around and who you're attracted to and who, you know, has the kind of character qualities that matter and who has similar values to you and who kind of shares the same vision of how they want to go through life.
Makes sense to me. What are you working on now?
I'm still writing some things for The Atlantic, and I'm about to start my next book.
And what will that be about?
I will wait to get further along before I start talking about it. Yeah.
Well, Laurie, it's just thank you so much for joining us and for sharing this rich information. I think that it's, you know, absolutely critical what you're suggesting. I love this practice of just writing down all the things that you think that you must need just to make it conscious so that you can let it go.
Yeah. It's really interesting, the feedback that I've gotten. I get so many letters from people who, you know, say that, you know, they really didn't think that they would be the kind of person that they assumed would be in the book, and yet they read the book and they really recognized themselves and they tried some of the things that I tried. And I think that's part of it, is that, you know, awareness, like you're saying, that, you know, we think that we're dating in a conscious way, but a lot of us are not.
Well, and then really looking for those deeper qualities that are going to be conducive to long-term partnership, if that's what you're wanting to create, like kindness and generosity and someone who wants the same things as you do. and to give these poor guys a chance.
Yeah, the guy. I'll tell you, the men are the biggest fan of this book, and not because this book has anything to do with, you know, give the guy who's like unattractive and boring
right.
a chance, because we, you know, I'm not saying that at all. But because there are so many guys out there who say, and they're married now, you know, and they'll say like, you know, yeah, these women, I'm so glad that I met my wife, because, you know, those women who wouldn't give me a chance, they're still single.
You know, that was really my experience. That I really went through a whole stage where I really felt for years like all the good ones are taken. There are no good guys out there. The kind of guy that I'm looking for doesn't exist. And
right.
I realized when I started doing Calling in the One that I needed to let go of that belief that it was such a limitation. And now it's amazing. I've been married for 4 years, but that was a process of deep transformation in me, where I did let go of a lot of those assumptions and beliefs of limitation, really opened up to possibility. And in my life, I can't even begin to tell you how many extraordinary single men I always meet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mm-hmm. don't you find that, Arielle,
oh,
as well? It's like
so many great guys.
There are
out there.
So many incredible, conscious, kind, generous, loving, spiritual, committed good guys out there in the world. It's just not true.
Right. And it's funny because I think, you know, a lot of us go through exactly what you said. You know, there are no good guys out there. They're all this way or that way. And, you know, instead of looking at it that way, maybe you are drawn toward the wrong kind of guys. And maybe there's something that you can be doing so that you will meet the kinds of guys that, you know, and you'll see all of a sudden when you do change your perspective, you start to all of a sudden you see all these guys out there that you never saw before. And you think, mm-hmm. wow, where were they? Well, they were right in front of you. I almost called this book, by the way, instead of like Mr. Right, Mr. Right in front of you. Because seriously, so many women ended up, you know, finding their guy, like, he was right in front of me. Mr. Right is right in front of you.
Yeah, you know, that's so true. I remember years ago, I was at a big convention with a friend of mine, and she said to me, do you ever notice all the men who are noticing you?
Right.
And I said, oh, there's nobody noticing me. And we were walking through this conference, and she said, did you see the guy who just walked by in the bathrobe? And I said, there's a guy in here in a bathrobe? She said, yeah, he just walked right past you. She said, you are just so intent and focused on things not related to men that you're missing all the guys who are checking you out all the time. And as soon as she brought it to my attention and I started widening my attention, I found out it was true. But I was just living in this space of, you know, there's no men, I never see them, they're not there, but they were everywhere.
They're everywhere, yeah, yeah. And I think that that's the thing that, you know, and if you think that there are no good guys out there, you know, one thing that I think I certainly learned in writing and reporting this book was, you know, maybe there was something that I was doing that was putting the wrong guys in my path instead of the right guys. And then once you kind of change your paradigm, then the right guys start coming into your path.
Well, I totally saw that for myself, that there was a way I was sourcing my value about, you know, what I could do or give to the men that I was dating. So, of course, I was, you know, attracted to men who needed a lot of my support and attention.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I realized if I was with someone who was able to really support me, that I might feel a little insecure and not know quite how to receive that.
Right.
And when I worked on shifting that, it was just amazing. There were just these extraordinary men everywhere. I just began to see it's not true.
Yeah, I've gotten letters of engagements from Mary Hem. You know, like it's really funny just how many people have all of a sudden, you know, seen that really there are these guys out there if you know how to look for them.
Well, it sounds very simple, but I think that the insights that you're providing are a huge mind shift for so many people who are seeking a partner. And it's that mind shift that actually keeps us really separate from and out of the flow of being able to really connect and attract and form the kind of bonds that would enable us to create deep soulmate partnerships.
Yes, exactly.
Where can people go to find out more about your work and find out about the paperback that's just come out?
They can go to my website, which is www.lorigottlieb.com, which is LoriGottlieb.com, and they can read all about the book and see reviews and, you know, get some information about it and find out where to buy it as well.
Mm. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to the Ultimate Soulmate Summit, brought to you by The Soulmate Secret and the Calling in the One online course. For more information about how you can download the audios in this series or order the CD set and companion workbook, please visit soulmateaudios.com. Again, that's soulmateaudios.com. On behalf of Ariel Ford, Claire Zammit, and our event partners, we want to thank you again for participating in this series and send you much love and support on your journey to manifesting your soulmate.